the HTB podcast. Subscribe now so you don't miss future episodes.
Hello, and welcome to the AHDB Potatoes podcast. This podcast is the first in a series discussing soil health, specifically in relation to the growing of potatoes. Soil health has a major impact on productivity and economic performance. And as part of our Great Soils Health campaign, headed up by Alice Sin and Amanda Bennett of AHDB, the aim here is to encourage potato growers to reconsider their current practices when it comes to soil health. This particular episode features Andy Steve, an agronomist for AgriVista Scotland. Andy will highlight the key questions that need to be asked by growers and agronomists alike when it comes to assessing land for future potato production. We also follow on with Philip Dunn, equity partner in the agribusiness consultancy at Brown & Co. He will address the current hot topic around growing potatoes and rented land. I'm going to introduce you now to Andy Stephen, who's an agronomist specialising in potatoes for AgriVista Scotland. Hello, Andy. Would you like to tell me a little bit about yourself, please, and the role that you play in supporting potato growers in Scotland?
I'm based up in northeast Scotland in Murrayshire and advise a lot of seed growers and some large ware growers as well. So I'm covering all aspects from pre-basic seed to certified seed and salad crops and pre-packed ware crops, as well as organic growers.
Lovely. So we're going to talk about the ideal site for growing potatoes. So from an agronomist point of view, could you actually discuss with me what qualities you would look for in a really good piece of land to actually look at planting a potato crop?
Well, ideally it would be flat, but given that's a pretty rare site up here, we'll look at things like slopes. You know, there's going to be factors in certain parts of the area up here where we're concerned about wind blow from soil type. Access is quite important. It's becoming more important because the size of machinery that's involved. So getting big harvester units in and out of fields and large tractor and trailers out to the field with the crop on board. You know, some old gateways are a bit of a challenge. Crop history is important. All the growers up here are now working on a minimum rotation of 7 years, and some of the pre-basic growers are still finding virgin land, but they would get land over 10 years if they can. So that provides extra challenges, keeping those wide rotations. And then we'll dig down deep into the crop history, try and find previous varieties. We undertake soil testing, so we'll look at the nutrient availability, soil types, organic matter, and as well as that, we do soil testing through SRUC for some of the pests that can infect potato crops. So we're looking for things like powdery scab and free living nematodes. For the seed growers, their PCN testing is all done through SASA on the statutory system, but we'll do some PCN testing for ware growers where they're concerned about risk from that. So we've got to take all these things into consideration and then start build a picture for ourselves so we know what we're facing come the spring when we actually start going into the field and growing the crop.
Lovely. So in terms of going on to pests, looking at sort of the situation with PCN, is land becoming more difficult to obtain that's PCN free, not just in Scotland, but in the UK as well? From your point of view, is it becoming more difficult?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The pressure's growing on that. You know, there's been a lot of work done recently over it. I was involved in a forum last year presenting a long-term PCN plan to the Scottish Government. And certainly the figures you hear in areas like Angus, where, you know, we could be one generation away from running out of clean land, is quite a scary statistic if you're a young person involved in the industry. So we've got to look after what we have and do a better job of looking after it.
So in terms of current best practice then, so we're saying that a rotation is 7 years. Are growers actually doing, you know, actually looking at doing longer rotations? Or because I think in the UK, sometimes we find, I think the average is something between 5.8 years between potato crops, which I think is very short. Are growers looking to actually sort of improve on that statistic?
The growers renting the land are trying to, obviously, they would like to keep that as wide a rotation as possible. for the landowners, the pressure's on the other way, because the potato crop's quite a nice rent coming in, relatively low risk. So they're under financial pressure to squeeze the land as much as they can. And it's a clash of perspectives and which way you go. But for a sustainable future, it's got to be longer.
Okay.
Otherwise, we're just building up problems that are going to come home to roost very shortly.
So in terms of renting land, then, what's the average that growers tend to look for in terms of actual rental periods when looking at new sites to grow potatoes on?
Well, certainly in the north, with seed growers, they're all looking at 7 years plus.
Right.
There's no one interested in going less than that because the risks are too high.
Okay.
And even the ware growers up here, they're not under so much pressure that, you know, there's less ware growing up here. So again, they ideally will be looking at 7 years plus. But I know, you know, in areas such as Angus, Fife, the Lothians, and down into England, East Anglia, where it's ware production is predominantly done, that the pressure's on. And yeah, you're looking at 5, 6, maybe 7 years rotations there. And that's going to be hard work to sustain that.
So talking about overall soil health then, do we think that it's prudent for growers to actually maintain up-to-date records of their fertilizer application, how many times they've had their land tested for PCN, free living nematodes, and other soil-borne diseases? Is that something that everybody does these days, or is it something that really needs to be improved upon from your point of view?
I'm not aware how extensively it's done. It's certainly something that I do and my colleagues do.
Mm.
There's good data recording systems that we're all using for keeping farm records on. So it is relatively simple to input that information and keep it stored so that the grower's always got it to hand. But good record keeping does help in the long term. You know, I've got records going back 30 years now in parts of Murrayshire where I've been farming and doing agronomy since 1991. And they're invaluable when you're able to go back and look at what the field history was, what crop quality was like coming out of a field. The growers certainly appreciate it when they know the risks that they're facing.
Okay. And so going back to looking at the site and accessibility, I think that's one thing that's often quite underrated, in the terms that obviously when you're talking about big machinery and, you know, some harvesting and the challenges that surround, you know, the whole lifting of a potato crop, you know, to later down the growing span, what would you recommend our listeners to look for when they're actually taking a piece of land into consideration when it comes to actual site and location?
Well, it's a lot of the basics. It's a lot of our instincts that farmers have naturally. But, you know, if you're looking at a north-facing slope or a south-facing slope, because there's going to be a huge difference in terms of crop performance and how early it's going to be. Is it sheltered? Is it going to be exposed to wind, which could damage crop? There was a really interesting bit of work done at James Hutton Institute where they're linking blackleg levels to the aspect and exposure of the field. So, you know, is that something in the future we're going to have more data on and be able to make a more risk-sensed decision on a field for a particularly blackleg susceptible variety? Things like access into the field. If the field's got a steep slope and you're coming in off a main road and it's a wet harvest, you know, what's the implications of that when you're suddenly taking trailers with muddy tyres back onto the road? Water running down the hill, do you plant the bottom end rig at all? Because there's a good chance that it could become a quagmire in a back end that gets very wet. So these are all things that you have to think about. And there's an extra cost there. If you don't plant it, you're still going to have to rent the field. So, you know, put that into the equation. All things that growers have to consider.
So that brings us quite neatly into soil structure and looking at the potential damage. I mean, you know, when farmers are actually renting their land out long term, did they put the onus on the agronomist and the tenant to actually add inputs and support the soil structure whilst they're growing potatoes? Is that something that we can improve upon, do you think?
I think it's certainly starting to come up in discussions. So in the past, maybe less so, but now, yeah, there are certain landowners who don't want to see their land given back to them in a poorer state than they rented it out at the start of the year. And so those discussions may occur more frequently going forward. And for the potato grower, again, it's all part of the equation there, building, you know, costs, low ground pressure tires on trailers and all that sort of thing suddenly come into the equation, and it makes life more complicated.
I can imagine. And that also would probably be the same, I'm assuming, for irrigation as well. I mean, will the factor of irrigation have an implication as to whether or not a grower or an agronomist advises on taking on a piece of land for growing potatoes? And, you know, is it a detrimental issue if there isn't any irrigation available? And how would that affect the soil health and the soil structure?
I think the irrigation's actually been part of that discussion for quite some time now. So, you know, land with irrigation was almost seen as being at a premium, and you could command a higher rent, and that's been the case for several years. It may become more so going forward, though. You know, how much irrigation is one thing, having an irrigation license, but is it enough to sustain a crop in a really dry year? So, yeah, these are considerations that people will have to make. Irrigation is not a massive factor up in the seed growing areas, but we do see climate change going the way it's predicted. You know, maybe it will become more of a consideration.
In terms of establishment then, is there anything do you think we could actually do better when it comes to actually sort of preparing the soil for that crop?
I think there's been good work recently showing that, you know, we need to be aware of the danger of over cultivating the soil. So, you know, this idea that we have to create the perfect seed bed and we end up with a really fine tilth that then slumps, or we work the soil too deep when we don't really need to, or we use things like bed tillers when we don't need to. But we do it because we've always done it and it's been part of a system, and the system moves around every field that the grower has and they do exactly the same thing for every field. So I think maybe we need to start thinking about tailoring cultivations to that specific field and what's needed more than we've done in the past. I'm not saying that it's not done already, because I do know growers do think about these things, but we maybe just need to fine tune even more.
I'm glad you said that, because I think it's an area that really, in my view, needs to, you know, people are starting to do this now, but they've always done it, but on what level? And I think with the whole implication now of soil structure and soil health and longevity of, you know, so growing crops in this country with limited land sources as well, it's such a key thing to actually bring to the fore right now. So in terms of take-home messages, looking at sort of planning for planting then, what would be your top tips just to finish off our conversation on?
Things I would certainly consider doing and encourage growers to do is do a risk assessment on every field and do the same risk assessment. So build a picture so that you can compare all your land base and see what the pluses and minuses for each site is. Do rigorous testing and history checking. So full soil analysis, get things like organic matter, because that can have a huge effect on how sustained the crop is in a drought. Higher organic matter fields are more resilient. But know everything that's in that field. So all your trace elements, your pH, your major nutrients. You know, gone are the days of just a pH and PK and MG test being sufficient. Get as big a picture as you can before you put any machinery into the field, and then look at, you know, some of the site-specific problems that you might encounter. So headland management, do we plant every headland? What are the implications with soil runoff and those sorts of things? Most growers are doing a lot of those things currently, but we just need to fine-tune it and do even more to try and preserve what we have. And then final consideration is, once you've left the field, you know, is there a long-term groundkeeper management plan? Some growers do that. They will speak to the landowner, they will rotate around the same farm over generations, and they will help the landowner control the groundkeepers, because they're looking after that asset base so that they can come back in 7, 8, 9 years' time and grow another good crop. So it's not just a case of walk out the gate and shut it.
Well, thank you very much. That's really, really useful information. And now we move on to Philip Dunn, equity partner in the agribusiness consultancy at Brown & Co, who will discuss how to approach the growers' rented land agreements and how to set up a contract. So hello, Philip. I'm going to ask you a few questions. Does a potential tenant of a potato field need a checklist of standards and requirements when it comes to entering a field and leaving the field in a certain condition?
Yes, and we always recommend this is clearly documented because there's a lot of nice handshake agreements that start nicely and end badly. First off, though, I just wanted to just clarify that point of tenant. So actually, there's three principal arrangements that people undertake for growing potatoes on others' land. There is a rental agreement where you are formally a tenant and the person with the land is a landlord. You take full right of occupation. That isn't very often undertaken with potatoes. The second route, which I'm about to detail, so the annual cropping license, is what's normally done. So in the situation where you have a license, you have no legal right of occupation. You are there to undertake an operation. Technically, the occupier, and most importantly, the occupier for BPS purposes, is actually the licensor, not the licensee. So quite a lot of difference there. And we can go into that later if you want a bit more detail.
That's really interesting, actually. I think you can just carry on with that at the moment because you started a conversation here and I've got some questions for you myself, actually, especially when it comes to the annual cropping license.
Okay, yeah. Well, just before we get into the detail, the third mechanism, which isn't used much now, it's called a crop purchase agreement, where essentially the crop is grown and then there's an undertaking to buy it back off the one that grows it at a set price and repaying certain costs. A little bit messy, that. So we tend to see one of the first two arrangements, either a formal rental or a crop license. And I would say crop license predominance, mainly because of the complications of renting. The land occupier might actually be a tenant and is prohibited from subletting, whereas licensing land can usually be done. Check your tenancy agreement, but usually isn't a problem. Also, the rental arrangements fell out of favour a bit when we had all the problems of transferring entitlements and short-term claiming on areas of land within the BPS system. So I say most people do it under licence, so they aren't the legal occupier. The legal occupier is the licensor, and they make the claim for basic payment. However, that does bring other problems. Obviously, the licensor, the farmer as opposed to the potato grower, is telling the RPA they are occupying the land and have management responsibility for it. So that means you have to be very careful with your licensor that they don't breach any of your cross-compliance rules. The licensor, the land holder, who is having to follow all the rules and make the claim, and it's their claim that's at risk. So, yeah, really, we see mainly cropping licences. And as you alluded to, there have to be a number of things in those licences and clearly documented to make sure we don't have any problems. So really, some of the basics there, you'd have an entry date and exit date. Quite often have, as you alluded to, penalty terms or requirements on exit. We would have to be very careful to state when the entry starts to make sure it's okay for planting, and also what state the field's in. You know, is it ploughed or do you take it as a stubble? Coming around to the exit date issue, that can be and has been in the last couple of years where we've had really wet autumns a big problem. We quite often have penalty clauses for late lifting or late field clearance. And in an extreme situation, some have made the licensee take the field for a second year for a different crop because it's got so late that the licensor can't grow a sensible crop afterwards. You can put whatever provision you want in a license, but those are some of the areas that need covering off. Other things such as cross-compliance breach and supply of data is really critical because the licensor is putting it on their form, saying they're occupying it. Should they get an inspection by the RPA, as they are the occupier, they are meant to be in control of the management of that parcel of land. They should know exactly what's happened to it. So all seed, fert and spray records need to be readily available And that would normally be written into the license agreement. Other things such as environmental schemes, you know, if there's any scheme options on that land, the knowledge of what there is and what needs to be adhered to needs to be clearly detailed in the license so that nobody falls foul of any of the rules. So, yeah, not quite straightforward. A lot done on a handshake, and fine, most of them get away with it, but I wouldn't recommend it. It's always
That's the thing, isn't it? I do feel that there is still quite a fundamental reliance on good old-fashioned, like you say, handshake agreements. And I think in this day and age, it's so important to actually get everything laid out, you know, in stone on a piece of paper in a proper formal contract so that everybody knows where they are. So would you say that those are the main pitfalls for a landowner to look out for when discussing letting his land out for growing potatoes?
Yeah, those are the main ones. Other sort of side issues that may or may not link to that are the availability of irrigation. That then leads to the cost and who applies, making sure people stick to the license and knowing exactly what the license is and the potential restrictions on that license. So all of that, again, once detailing, it adds a further complication to it. Obviously, a lot of land is irrigated for potatoes and needs to be.
And costly too. So, which brings me to ask you about financial outgoings. And when it comes to renting land for potato production, is it actually a viable thing to do?
Yes, of course it is. I mean, it enables potato growers to get access to additional area. It allows them potentially to rest the rotation within their own land base, and or allows expansion of a potato grower's area that he can produce from. So there's certainly a demand, and provided things, the soil types and all the criteria I described earlier are met, then yeah, it's a very sensible thing to do. When you talk about returns, I don't know if you want me to get into the complexity of the prices that get paid, but just bear in mind. When you mention rentals there, just remember that's different to licensing again, because if it's a rental, the potato grower will be the applicant for the BPS, and therefore whatever the BPS amount is, obviously that's in a changing scenario from this year onwards, that goes to the person occupying the field. Whereas in a license situation, that makes up part of the return for the man and woman supplying the land. So obviously there's that, what would have been £90 an acre difference between the two arrangements from the start. But if we said licensing, so the situation where the potato grower is not claiming any basic payment, I have quite a nice range for you there, depending on quality of soil and all the other factors that I mentioned earlier. But I would say if I was to be asked to put my neck on the line, in the range of £250 to £350 per acre for licence. There are always exceptions. Please don't ever quote me on those. I've got some Scottish seed growing land where I have to pay up to £550 an acre, purely due to quality of soils, competition, etc. So it is a wide range, but I think if that £250 to £350 for the ground only under licence per acre is about where the market's at.
Lovely. So I'm going to talk about irrigation because we touched on that earlier on in this conversation. So is there any protection for the tenant when, you know, irrigation is promised but doesn't get it?
Well, yes. If it's promised and it doesn't arrive, then the tenant would certainly have a case. Mm. How exactly he'd implement and how you'd quantify any damages would be very difficult. I think rather than get into that position, it wants clearly laying out in whichever agreement you take, where clearly there is a license available, there is an abstraction rate, there is an abstraction period, but that always has to be subject to any restrictions that are beyond the control of the person who holds the license. So if we get a drought and restrictions come on to summer abstraction, then that needs to be written into the agreement as a potential problem, which is beyond the control of both parties, really. Mm. If the water's coming from a reservoir, probably less of a problem because it's there, but there's still the mechanics of the underground supply and the pumping of that water to make sure it is available at those critical times. But it's down to who has which responsibility there. You know, at which point does the person growing the potatoes take the water? Is it X the borehole, X the reservoir, or is it to the distribution point in the field? So again, a complex area, but just needs covering off.
So that's the same, I suppose, with inputs, really. So when a piece of land's taken on, do we looking at, does it have to be as bare stubble or winter ploughed? And if it's ploughed beforehand, who pays for that work to be done? Would that be the new tenant or the current owner of the land?
It would all be down to a particular circumstance. In some situations, the potato grower likes to do that early preparation. So removing any compaction, making sure the ground is turned over at the correct time. Others would say, well, we'll enter on ploughing, but please plough it in such a manner at such a time before I come. There really isn't a hard and fast rule on that as to how land is taken. It just depends on the situation.
Super. Thank you very much. What I'm going to ask you now is in relation to the fact we're doing a whole series of soil health-based webinars for potato growers. And one thing that's so topical at the moment is soil structure and soil damage caused by machinery and you know, sort of establishment techniques. So, for example, if the harvest is made late, you know, by poor weather and then consequential soil damage occurs, no cropping may not be able to establish until the following April. Would that need to be written into the contract?
We can have it written into either the rental agreement or the license agreement where there is a clause that the potato grower needs to return the land into, and it's difficult to put the description, but in a good manner, capable of growing the next crop, which really could mean, and you can detail it, whether it needs the headland subsoiling or any ruts taking out, soil levelling, soil compaction removal. But again, not always practical. If you're sat in the middle of November and it's a very saturated soil, that's not going to be easy to undertake, if not impossible to undertake. So it's quite often down to the will of both parties to leave it in a sensible state, with potential penalty clauses if it isn't. And there needs to be a means of arbitration of that. So in the agreement, it would need to state who would say whether it's in a good state or a satisfactory state or not. So there's usually a clause in there to say who would determine the state of the field after the crop. There's an element of risk in it to the landowner. You know you're going to be involving a lot of heavy machinery and a lot of crop movement at a potentially wet period of time, but that's the risk of the party providing the land.
So basically you're saying obviously site is one of the most critical factors when it comes to actually looking at renting land out for growing of potatoes. It's a bit of an elephant in the room subject, this, really, I suppose, because, you know, there seems to be a lot of talk about the availability of rented land and the pitfalls of, you know, sort of being a landowner and letting your land out, because you don't know what sort of state it's going to come back in, especially when it comes to things like potatoes and carrots, for example. So what's your viewpoint on that now? Because I think things have changed quite considerably over the last 10 years when it comes to obtaining land and, you know, some machinery practices as well. Do you feel that this is something that needs to be addressed a little bit more and growers need to be more aware now as to what they're getting into?
I think generally people growing potatoes now are, dare I say it, more professional than they were 10, 20 years ago. They are more specialised. The soil that is suitable for them is fewer and far between, because the criteria to get all of those criteria correct is more critical to get the optimum performance from that land. So you could say the supply has narrowed as the specialism has increased, but equally the supply of land probably will come a little bit greater as the pressure on returns from other crops increases. There may be more farmers willing to take that risk, those risks that you've detailed, such as late lifting and compaction of soils, because still that license stroke rental return is significantly better than the next alternative, particularly where we're struggling for break crops or the economics of some continuous cropping systems are getting less profitable. So I think, the changing environment, I think people want a more specific soil to rent or license, but there may be more people coming forward if the economics dictate that it's a better option for them than alternative crops.
Okay.
There is a slight added complication in there as well. Obviously, the BPS, whether you're renting it or licensing, that's dropping away. So if people were looking at the sum of the BPS and the license fee to being their total return, by the nature of the BPS reducing over the next 7 years, then the sum of the two isn't going to be as big, whether they'll ask the same amount and or whether they'll take some of that knock as the land provider. Who knows? We haven't got to that position yet.
So that brings me to the conversation of elms, really. Do you think that that will actually make a significant difference when we actually convert from the current scheme into the new elm scheme?
Good question, because we don't really know what elms is yet. But yeah, potentially coming in. What it does complicate is whatever it actually involves when we get to it. We have an area-based payment. We're likely to have a payment based upon a number of other criteria, which will just complicate matters in terms of land agreements. So if cultivational practice, soil inversion, green covers over winter are all elements of elms payments, it's muddying the waters, sorry with the pun, but not quite so straightforward, is it? It's not, this is my land, I can get X pounds an acre or a hectare. It might be much more complicated to do with practices undertaken in that field, which then it doesn't have such clear boundaries as our current system. So yeah, it could lead to problems, not insurmountable, but as we don't really know what elms will involve as yet, very difficult to say what those problems will be. But if we look at soil, air, carbon, water, environment, so the key players in new funding schemes within elms, all of those will have an impact on such arrangements, because I don't want to condemn the potato industry, but it's fairly aggressive in terms of the environment. There's a lot of soil inversion, there's a lot of soil movement. There's a lot of high inputs. There's a lot of blight sprays go on. It's not the most environmentally friendly practice.
It does have a certain reputation, doesn't it, Philip?
At the current time, obviously, people will adapt practices in line with what policy dictates. There'll be changes required from both parties on that to make it all right and add up. And we haven't got there yet, but we'll have to think about those as they come along.
Well, this is one of the key things that AHDB are actually trying to address at the moment in terms of looking at how to approach the environmental factor of crop production, especially in potatoes. We're trying to develop a new way of thinking and encourage our growers to actually look at things a little bit more holistically in terms of different ways to produce a potato crop. So the fact that we're discussing about renting land is just a small part of the bigger picture that when it comes to actually trying to produce really good crop of potatoes, and a valuable crop of potatoes as well, not one that's actually going to end up being downgraded, for example, if it's a seed potato crop, or if the land choice, land selection is poor and causes problems. So I've just got one more thing for you, actually, Phil. So do you have any take-home messages when it comes to considering renting your land out as a farmer?
I think the overall message is that you're almost forming a bit of a longer-term joint venture-type relationship. It isn't one on one side, one on the other. You both want to work together for the best outcome. And I think that is by having clear debates and discussions, covering the sorts of topics and areas of issue that we've detailed this morning. Just have a sensible debate through it, find a way through it all. If there's two willing parties, it will continue to happen. I think, again, that's down to the professionalism of the parties involved. They need to understand that, you know, there's a lot involved, and to make it all work best for both parties, they need to have those debates and document where they both stand. And then, great, it's a good opportunity for both.
I think documentation is a key point here, especially when it comes to actually deciding which type of license or agreement, making sure that data is available to both parties in terms of inputs throughout the course of the arrangement. And also, I suppose, from a tenant's point of view, is there anything, you know, that can be included in that arrangement? So to looking at things they can do better to ensure that both parties part on good terms at the end of a cropping arrangement.
Well, generally doing what you say you're going to do is always a good thing.
Yes.
But quite often weather and external factors prevent some of that happening. You are lifting a lot of crop out of a ground with a lot of heavy machinery at traditionally quite a wet time of the year. So there isn't a way around that really, other than, you know, you might be growing on third party land, some earlies or second earlies, depending on the circumstance, or even seed crops where you can guarantee to be off the ground earlier and possibly on it later in the spring, which would obviously help. So again, it's parties talking to each other is the solution to that one.
That's lovely. Well, thank you very much, Philip, for taking the time to talk to us today on this podcast.
Okay, no problem. Thank you very much.
I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Thank you very much for listening. You can find further information and documentation, such as the Soil Management Guide, on our website.